You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today my guest is Howard Norman. He's the author, most recently, of The Bird Artist, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, of a book of short stories called Kiss in the Hotel Joseph Conrad, and a previous novel, The Northern Lights. I thought I'd begin by talking about some of the folkloric background of this book. You're an ethnologist?
Well, not formally, but I have done translations and work in native areas, Algonquin and Inuit Arctic areas, and traveled and lived in the northern parts of Canada for 11 or 12 years and became reasonably proficient. I would never say fluent, but reasonably proficient in a number of languages and still translate folk tales, myths, songs, and so forth on a pretty much almost daily basis. I work with these languages.
You know, in a certain kind of writing, the North, the frozen and icy North, is represented as a place where people who have been inadequately passionate are sent to be punished. I'm thinking particularly of a novella called Peter Schlemihl, where a character is sent via his seven-league boots to the Arctic, where he, and this is sort of miraculous given your book, becomes a classifier of flora and fauna. That is to say that this classification system seems to be part of passionlessness. Mm-hmm. Since your hero, the bird artist, is someone who is very concerned with the detailing of natural life, which he sees killed all around him,
yes,
by his parents, and also is someone who has difficulty expressing the passions when he feels them, I thought I'd begin by asking you about him.
Well, the character's name is Fabian Voss, and he was a character that, I mean, I think empathy is sort of the basis of character, at least for me in my writing. And I was researching a film for a Canadian film company in the east coast of Newfoundland and was put up in an Anglican church there. And in that room that I was in, there was a watercolor of an ibis, a wading bird. And I was there for several weeks, and every day I would look at this and realize that it was a very accomplished painting, watercolor painting. And the only other distinguishing fact about it was that it had the date 1911, no name. And I started thinking, what must it have been like to have that particular talent in that fairly isolated place at that time? And I researched it a little bit, just enough so that it got my imagination going about what was possible to have happened there. Then I stopped. And the name Fabian Voss came off an old town register that I'd found. And all along it was what must it have been like for this man, this young man, who I found out, to live in that place in that time and have this talent. The other characters came later.
So you don't regard Fabian's talent as being representative of something a bit stillborn or scientific in him?
No, I think the impulse to chronicle, perhaps, was one of those things that, like you described, perhaps an unfocused kind of knowledge about himself, that perhaps he did have that kind of meticulousness about him. Passionate, yes, rather unwieldy. In the early drafts of this novel, there was a section that I ended up throwing out, which really described a day's work where far more mistakes were made than things kept. But it was sort of lugubriously describing, you know, the creative process and all that. But within that, I think I would agree with you that there was this need to chronicle one's surroundings. And as you say, the father and his lover, Margaret Handel, and just about everybody else there killed birds, whereas he was, in a way, a drawing was like an epitaph, you know. And so in that way, yes, I think it was a kind of scientific bent.
Well, I found him as being someone sort of on the threshold of life, you know, initiated into the ways of love by Margaret.
Yep.
He nevertheless can't propose to her, almost as if, you know, someone who needs to still something in its flight. This is, it seems to me, a coming-of-age novel set in 1910, and it's about what allows this person finally, to whatever extent he can, to stop being so frozen and perhaps to fly.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, and I think that there were a lot of people, to extend your metaphor, trying to thaw him out,
right.
I mean, in various ways. And it took a violent, one might argue that it took a violent moment to do that. A sequence of violent moments to do that. But I would agree, and of course, one of the problems of a first-person narration is that you don't want to rely utterly on a kind of inherent passivity in the narrative voice.
Mm-hmm.
But I did want him consciously to have this, all his energies going into the creation of art.
And this happens or is related in the first sentence of the book, so we're not spoiling anything for, you know, ingenuous readers. He murders his mother's lover. His father is still alive. She's been, the book says, an adulteress. And in this way, this betrayal of the father, this anger at the mother, the character resembles Hamlet, which, as soon as I thought, well, that's another northern legend. Did Hamlet come into the mix literally, and how did it enter this book?
I would not say that it was a blueprint in any way, thematically or perhaps just in terms of any kind of chronology. I would more say, and I would in fact definitely say, that the, hopefully, the big opposing forces, the emotional dimensions of this novel, were influenced. I don't mean that to be an evasive answer, only that I hadn't read Hamlet, you know, in terms of preparing for this book, but it's such an indelible story that it came back around and during the writing of it, not in the way perhaps that one would see Shakespeare in the recent work of someone like Jane Smiley,
mm-hmm.
something along those lines, but sort of more deep down in the psyche perhaps. And yes, I would agree.
Well, I found myself thinking, actually, not so much, I guess, of Shakespeare's Hamlet, but of the story that Shakespeare drew himself from, that somewhere behind this book there's an ur-myth about fathers, sons, adultery, spirit, ghosts, and that very much this place is a barren, cold place like Elsinore. Ghosts are walking, there are omens and superstitions, and, you know, this is the story of a young man coming into his own at the center of an environment full of suspicion.
Indeed, and you brought up folk tales earlier on, or myths, and I think that having translated so many northern stories and read them and heard so many of them, you know, one of the things that happens is the structure of those stories, wherein things repeat themselves, but not quite the same way each time,
mm-hmm.
and I very, very much made that a formal construct in this book. And in that way, I felt I could accommodate characters of all sorts of disparate intentions and the old people, the young people, the middle-aged people, people stuck in their whatever lives they have, people longing fiercely to leave, not knowing how. All those extremes which are exacerbated in a rather claustrophobic and largely winter place. And in that sense, I do consider it having a strong connection and a strong influence by the sort of archetypal northern story.
Mm-hmm.
In that way. And I'm drawn to those places. I'm drawn to remote places where two things happen. One, where despite the fact, or perhaps because of the fact, everyone knows everything about everyone else, to cultivate a secret or private life is an extraordinary skill.
Mm-hmm.
It's not always a conscious one. I've experienced that in those places many, many times. And secondly, to try to find characters who, already being in a remote area through their behavior, become more remote, not necessarily physically leaving the place, but within themselves. And for me, that's my fictional territory, or it has been.
Mm-hmm. I'm talking to Howard Norman, the author of The Bird Artist. This book is set in Newfoundland, and we're talking about myths of the North. I was therefore comparing, I don't know, the underlying substructure of these Northern novels with those of South America, so that, you know, in a certain way, if fog and ice are the dominant weather metaphors in The Bird Artist, rain and humidity, of course, in the South, and things tend to, therefore, come in the magic realism novel of South America in rains of butterfly,
yes,
rains of gold. And in this Northern novel, of course, ghosts are central because ghosts are fog-colored. And a woman here in this book drinks milk. She not only drinks milk, but collects milk, old milk, rancid milk. But it seemed as if, you know, there's a color scheme, not just of the place, but of the internal mythology of place.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you're referring to the character named Helen Twombly, who is really the, I guess you would say, repository of all the old. And what I had tried to do there, I didn't take it quite to the extreme that I had thought I would, because in the orchestration of events and of characters here, it didn't seem to balance out right. But I initially wanted to have somebody who was absolutely instructed only by superstition, that she had distilled her life down to a few basic instructions every day, and therefore represented utterly the past. And she, of course, sets out into that fog and uses the fog as sort of the ultimate camouflage, because she disappears and drowns. And people with their lanterns, the lights, the only lights that they're given, can't find her. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, when you're up in those areas too, it does seem natural to think about and develop, as a writer, the landscape and the weather as a character almost itself, because it's so ubiquitous and it interacts so forcefully. The import of weather on people's lives is so tremendous and varied that to not do that seemed to be a misguided choice.
But I think that characterologically as well, not to roll Susan Sontag in here bodily, but, you know, there's a kind of person who treasures an extinct volcano.
Mm-hmm.
Another is drawn to glaciers, a third to moss, and all of these qualities of nature, qualities of the environment, I think inform a certain kind of story.
I do too. You know, this area where this book takes place, there are wonderful writers up there whom we don't get to read down here too often for various reasons. One of the things I noticed about a lot of the novels and short stories and radio plays and so forth, that come out of Newfoundland or the Maritimes, I should say, in general, is these qualities that you're talking about. How do characters get mesmerized and obsessive about the very things they've been surrounded with their whole life? That's a very common motif in stories that come out of there. Mm-hmm. I remember one, and I can't remember the author, set in Nova Scotia about a guy who literally, since he was maybe 8 or 9 years old, had been a painter of weather vanes because his father had a little shop, you know, and it took off in a direction in which, of course, he became a maker of weather vanes and so on and so forth. And I understood that. I understood that story. It wasn't an Edgar Allan Poe kind of macabre obsession, but the obsession of propinquity and of familiarity and sort of the hands-on entering of things you've looked at and been around your whole life. And I think in a lot of ways drownings are like that, that people, early explorers' journals talk about drownings in Newfoundland a lot, and they use terms like the sea invites many people a year to join it. There's almost a kind of whimsical reciprocality that goes on there, and in some ways, I don't find that exaggerated or embroidered. I find it very, very true.
Well, I think that there's always a rhetoric that goes with a place. Yeah. You know, in a certain sense, you know, just as somehow or other, it's not to copy Shakespeare, somehow or other, the drowned woman, whether Ophelia is present or not, will always somehow be surrounded, not necessarily by flowers, but by a collection of superstitions about a natural object. Yeah. In her case, God knows why, milk.
Well, it's one of those little quirky things that you try to fit into a novel because you've seen an example of it, and you try to wedge it in, and it may have been a right or wrong choice, but it seemed right for her.
Now tell me, at a certain point in this book, Margaret, the lover, who shoots a photograph of her rival, and famously, at least according to town lore, when she gets stuck with the old maid or old hag, as they call it in a game of old maid, she eats the card and promises that she'll order a new deck for them. she's the most, in what I'm trying to describe as a novel about distance from passion, she's the most demonstrative character.
Yes. Yeah.
And seems to be the one who, in another world, would be the action character.
Yeah. Time magazine today called her the Annie Oakley of Newfoundland. And I sort of laughed because she does shoot up a number of things, including the church at the end. I hope not as often as is implied by that. But Margaret Handel, the first draft of this book was entirely sort of a biography of her from birth till death.
I thought so.
Because I met a woman in St. John's who was in her 80s who said many interesting things to me, but one of the things she said was in the village she was raised in, which was a place called Heart's Content in Newfoundland, that she was ostracized because she was 26 and unmarried. And she left it alone at that. But if empathy is the basis for character, that made me empathize with this particular character.
Mm-hmm.
And Margaret does almost everything on her own volition, including drinking a lot. And she was always the central reason for me to write this book, if I can be so presumptuous about it. I think that she was. And what I really wanted most is to have a novel in which, even when she wasn't present on the page, people would wonder what she was up to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where was she? What was she doing? What scheme was she up to? How was she trying to puppeteer events in this story?
Mm-hmm.
And I also wanted her to be changed by events and changed by tragedies, but not completely, not entirely. I didn't want it to have a smack of... I didn't want any contemporary psychologies to be imposed on any of these characters.
Well, you know, it's sort of funny because whenever that kind of thing veers into the narrative, and a couple of times the minister brings them in, he's chided for his foolish phrasings and his ridiculous interpretations.
Yes.
But I did feel that if psychology was not to be brought to bear, that something mythic was behind implicitly this book. Maybe I can limit a little bit. Fabian seems to be surrounded by teachers of different kinds. He has his father, but he has a father tutor, a father figure, a paternal wisdom figure, the man, invisible Sprague, who he has a correspondence course with about bird drawing.
Yes.
And Sprague seems to be that mentor character or the prophet character or some offstage the oracle. And you know, of all, the minister seems to be advancing certain kinds of theological reading life by interpreting the Bible, the life of Jesus, as a model for the interpretation of human life. And it seems as if what Fabian's job is to do is to get past interpretation and morality.
Yes, I think so. And I think, I mean, you bring up a couple characters there. I mean, I think that the minister, Reverend Sillett, does have a certain rhetoric which annoys almost everybody. Some tolerate it and some go after it. And really, in the case of Margaret, for instance, tries to dismantle it. There's a dance in the book in which she simply comes up and grabs him and wipes the sweat off his brow with a hem of her dress. And I thought that's a direct statement about not only her feelings about him, but her feelings about that kind of rhetoric in which she has no interest in whatsoever. On the other hand, in that community, in those types of communities, the church and that particular kind of reverend would be very central to it and would be a sort of a local judge, in a way, and as you say, a judge of the ethical dimensions of trying to form the ethical dimensions of the community. So I wanted Margaret, as feisty as she is and as savvy as she is, to have big enemies, to have big adversaries. You know, I basically consider this book a love story. I mean, that sounds very sappy, but I never wanted to write anything but that, in which the framework was a love story. And when I look back on it, I see that the sort of education of the poet, which starts out in a local library, never really ends. I mean, at the end, he's still getting instructed from all sorts of people.
Well, I'm talking, by the way, to Howard Norman, the author of The Bird Artist, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. It fascinated me that the witness to his 5-minute-long wedding is also the judge of the hearing at which he's accused of being a murderer, the hero of the book, Fabian Voss. And it struck me that many themes of this book converge around the idea of witnessing and of judging.
Absolutely right. I think that's really right. And it may be one of the few things, admittedly, that I was conscious of from the beginning.
Thank you.
I mean, there weren't too many. I mean, I'm going to put a disclaimer on that right away. There weren't too many, and I don't know that writers really know. I mean, some writers do and some don't. I certainly did not know a lot of the patterns that were developing in this book. That was one that was I was conscious of. Perhaps every writer needs an anchor, needs something to keep returning to, a narrative line or something to keep their senses intact when they're writing. And that was certainly one of them.
Well, don't you think it's an interplay between the reason for intention is that eventually it enters into collaboration with everything that's unconscious, too,
yeah.
and that finally intentions, whatever they may begin as, end as something quite different.
Yes, they do, and unpredictably so, and happily unpredictably, because otherwise, you know, you're too much in control of the material and you're suppressing it, I think. The Constable Mitchell Kelb, who you describe, is the one character I'm curious about after the book ends. I sort of feel the other characters have been taken care of in a certain way. But he seems to be kind of a loose cannon, and I really got interested in him at the end of the book.
Could this be because you're writing a novel called The Museum Guard?
I never thought of that. I never thought of The Museum Guard is a whole other. It's a book I started before this one and set aside, which has been a pattern of mine. And it's possible, yeah. He may show up, not as Mitchell Kell, but as a type.
Uh-huh.
You know, taciturn and yet, in all his formality, a kind of idiosyncratic figure.
Well, there was a Scottish word that Dwight MacDonald used to use around me. It was pawky to describe many of these characters, kind of canny and taciturn at once.
Yep, right. I mean, it strikes me as accurate to Newfoundland. I hope people will forgive me for stereotyping, and it's why I keep going back there. I enjoy it so much.
The pawky Newfies.
The pawky.
Do you spend much of your time up there?
Well, I overall, I think since I was 20, you know, I must have been there 25 or 30 times. The last time I was there was last August when I traveled up with Arnie Glimcher, who bought this book for Warner Brothers. We spent 10 days up in communities up there, and it was quite a good time and quite interesting. And funny for me, because we would drive up and a sign would say, "Welcome to Witless Bay," and Arnie would turn to me and say, "You've got to be kidding."
It is.
I'd say, you know, where did you think I got these things? Because there it's not exotica from a distance. I mean, you know, it is.
Nothing is exotic up close, I guess.
No, I think that's the point. I mean, you look at any map, for instance, just in terms of the nouns, the place names. I mean, they're just wonderfully inventive anywhere.
I've been speaking to Howard Norman, the author of The Bird Artist, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Thank you very much for
my
joining
pleasure.
Me today. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Scott Fritz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of ice and snow in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages. Back to days of old when knights were bold and books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book of the mouse pop time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.